the student ID card had become a form of payment on campus. I wanted to eat off campus. I thought, why don't I just build a card for off campus? And so I started a thing called the Green Card and started building what really was the first sort of host-based stored value processing system. But for me, it was just a way to kind of eat off campus.
Welcome back to Success Unscripted, the podcast where we peel back the curtain on real stories of success in the business world. I'm your host, Jonathan Israel, a financial advisor with Affinity Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services. To make my compliance officers happy, I'll mention that UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC. My office is located in Los Angeles, California, and I can be reached at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Joining me today is Mitch Jacobs. Mitch is the CEO and founder of Plink, an online platform that enables small businesses to target customers in their neighborhood. His first two payment businesses were acquired by public companies, and his last, OnDeck, debuted on the New York Stock Exchange in 2014. Mitch is an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, and his companies have twice appeared on Inc. 500 and Forbes Most Promising Companies lists. After getting his start with what can only be described as a hostile takeover of the Dartmouth meal plan, Mitch has cemented his place as a true financial technology pioneer. And stay tuned after the interview for a short success story about someone you might know. Here's my conversation with Mitch Jacobs. Mitch, thank you for coming in.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and your side gig, a husband and father to three teens.
That's the most important gig there is.
And the hardest one.
And the hardest one.
Yeah.
Particularly the teen part.
Right. Yeah. Good. I'm not quite there. So that's coming for me quick. I think it's worth explaining and emphasizing your role in the fintech and payments industry. Fintech, of course, is a portmanteau. It's been around for a long time. It actually first was used in 1967. So it goes back that far. It refers to the application of technologies in the financial sector. There was a significant turning point in the late 90s, the dot-com era. And who was there at that time? You were.
I was there.
You were there. Would it be too much if I referred to you as a founding father of fintech?
I mean, go with OG or founding father. Both are good.
Either way, you were a pioneer when this was getting its legs in the 90s. And so, like Lewis Carroll said, begin at the beginning. So let's start with your background and where you grew up.
I grew up in upstate New York, not actually too far from the city, but a place that was very, very rural, very blue collar. That's very different from where we're sitting here in LA.
So you didn't grow up in a tech or business community?
No, not at all. Not at all. And my family, you know, parents and aunts and uncles were all, you know, doctors, educators, really no business to be seen anywhere.
Did you have any early seeds of entrepreneurship?
I didn't realize it at the time, but yeah, I was one of those kids who was always sort of thinking about things in two ways, you know, what you're experiencing, but then also what business might be behind it.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. There's a great quote by Mark Twain. I've never let schooling interfere with my education, which I find rather apropos. Talk to me about your time at Dartmouth.
When I got to Dartmouth, I was kind of continuing what I did in high school, which was just involvement in lots and lots and lots of things. And then I actually took a semester abroad. And then after that, took a semester off and went and skied. And when I came back to school, I found myself kind of like not doing all of that student activity stuff. And I just was working off campus and going to classes and thinking about like, what are the other things I might do? And at the time, my experience at Dartmouth was sort of different from a lot of my friends. They could eat off campus anytime they wanted to. They kind of had a lot more money than I did.
And Dartmouth is an expensive school.
Dartmouth is an expensive school, yeah. But there's plenty of people who go to Dartmouth who don't really notice how expensive a school it is. But right. I did. And I was working at the off-campus businesses at that time. The student ID card had become a form of payment on campus. And I realized that that was really impacting those businesses off the campus because now more and more of the student dollar, the meal plan, all the additional discretionary dollars were all on the card, and the card could only be used on campus. And so I wanted to eat off campus. I thought, why don't I just build a card for off campus? And so I started a thing called the Green Card, which I started my junior spring. I started sort of thinking about it and then skipped an internship in New York, stayed in New Hampshire, and basically worked on building the business that summer. And it got off the ground, got businesses involved, got parents to start sending in money. And I realized I can't go back to school. And so I didn't. The first day of senior year, my friends kind of went off to class and I went off to this tiny office I had rented on the second floor of Main Street and started building what really was the first sort of host-based stored value processing system. But for me, it was just a way to kind of eat off campus.
I love that. I love that the motivation was just wanted to eat off campus. But how did you take this from an idea to something that you put into reality? Like you needed to go to all the merchants and get them on board. You needed to get this out to parents. I don't know how you did. How did you do all that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for anyone who's looking to go and do something that they're going to like start from scratch, I think one of the things that I didn't do, which probably people would say was, they would look at it through the traditional lens and say it was irresponsible, is I didn't really think that far ahead. You know, I knew that I wanted to do this. I actually was like reading in my Econ 101 book, which was written by Dr. Alan Blinder, for a Princeton economist, who, by the way, later ended up being a board member of mine at OnDeck. But I was reading in his Econ 101 textbook, you know, one of those like side panels that gives you a little more detail on something. And it was describing debit cards in Sweden and Japan. There were no debit cards or no gift cards in the United States at the time. That idea didn't exist.
What year was this?
This was 1993.
In 1993, debit cards didn't exist in the
US. I mean, they existed, but there was no penetration. The history of that in the fintech world is like, for 20 years, it was the year of the debit card. Everyone kept expecting it to happen. And it wasn't until, you know, late 90s, early 2000s that it really actually started to take hold. But I looked at that and said, all right, well, I'm just going to build a debit card. And beyond that, I didn't do a heck of a lot of planning. I mean, I started out with what would be called a very analog system. Like I was using three-part receipts and people would make a purchase and sign a receipt and the business would keep one and the student would keep one and one would go in a bin and I'd walk around and collect those twice a week. And that was our processing system.
No way.
Yeah. And then I found, and you know, I mean, at the time, you'll remember those little like gray boxes. Maybe you would remember the little gray boxes that were the first like credit card machines that weren't
knucklebusters.
Like well, there was the knucklebusters, but then that got replaced by the Verivone Zon like terminal that was like the first one.
Right.
And so I had to find someone who could program those. And I found a Verifone person who would moonlight. They were in Margarita. It's somewhere not too far from here.
Okay.
Anyway, so they were in California and I got them to like moonlight and write code. And then I found two guys in St. Louis who programmed an authorization system. They flew to Hanover and like came to my dusty office and like wrote code for a couple of weeks. I don't even remember how I financed the whole thing. It just kind of went from that analog to this digital system. That really, I mean, we got half of the student body to participate in the program.
I guess you spread the word among the students and then they get their parents to...
Yeah, actually, what I did was I entered all the information from the student, like the Facebook, basically, you know, the freshman book. I entered all of the addresses into a database and then mailed home to all the parents. And that first day when I walked to my office, which was kind of a terrifying experience to realize I wasn't going to be graduating with friends. And I was on this journey. My student mailbox was jammed with $800,000 worth of checks. And so that calmed me down a little bit.
Wow.
Yeah. So the college ultimately came after me for using that book.
I was going to ask you, for using the book, for maybe even competing with their meal program.
Yeah, this thing had an impact. The green card decimated the Dartmouth Dining Services. And so the first thing they did was try and sue me for the book, for using the addresses. But my brother, who was a 1L law student, and I figured out that there was a court case like sheer drudgery does not constitute copyright. It was Feist versus Rural Publications. So we use that as our defense. Like you can't just take a list of facts, which is like everyone's names, and copyright it.
Right.
And so Dartmouth had to relent on that. Then like a year later, they came after me for using the image of Baker Tower, which is like the campus library tower, using that as like their protected image, but reminded them that that's a three-quarter model of Independence Hall, which is in the public domain. So after that, there was this like meeting in the back of a diner with the president, like the VP and treasurer of the school, who then asked us to take over the school's program. So we ended up running the campus program at that point.
That's amazing.
And I started rolling out to a bunch of other schools, and then was acquired by Student Advantage in 1999.
What did you learn from that business that stuck with you?
A lot. I learned from the ground up how payment networks work. And there's not many people who have the experience of building sort of end-to-end a payment network. But I also learned a lot about, entrepreneurship and how the whole process from scratch to scale works. The company was bought as part of an IPO, so I got a front row seat to the IPO process, and that was great. You know, I think one of the things that I took away that venture capitalists will talk about a lot is like, what is the unique insight that you have? So those things were a bunch of skills, mm-hmm. but I think the unique insight that I walked away with, which has stuck with me till today, is how powerful the payment network is as a way of connecting people. And that the role that we were playing, because we had, and this is the key difference, a lot of people don't realize that the credit card system or the debit card system they use today is actually two totally separate industries. There is the industry that issues you a card. That's the card that's in your wallet or on your phone. That is an industry that is totally separate from the merchant acceptance industry. And that's the industry that goes out and signs up merchants to accept the card that is in your wallet or on your phone. And in between the two, there are these networks, MasterCard and Visa. And so their job is to connect these two totally independent worlds. And that was an incredible infrastructure that was built for the purpose of eradicating cash and checks from the face of the earth. Like when that thing was designed, it was brilliant for scale. But fast forward to today, where we all want these personalized experiences and banks want to deliver us personalized experiences. And, you know, if you really pay attention, it's like, it's not happening. Like people aren't really receiving all of the personalized experiences that get talked about all the time in the, you know, advertising of financial services. Well, a really fundamental reason is because those two industries, the card side and the merchant side, they completely separate out all the data, all of the functionality. Like if you're on the card side, you have no idea who the merchant is. That was true. It's true today. It was true in in the 90s when I was building the green card. But what we had at the green card is we had those two sides together. We had the cardholder side and the merchant side, the same platform. And that enabled us to really create commerce magic. Like the experience that we could deliver to every individual person, even back then with so many of the technology tools that do not exist today, mm-hmm. because we had the data in the same place, we were the ones who issued the cards and we were the ones who were working with the merchants. We could constantly adjust price at the system level for each individual. And that was a really powerful thing, being able to really impact the commerce between a consumer and a merchant continuously, like all the time and up to the minute, like in the afternoon, changing what was going to take place that evening. And the impact on being able to create a more healthy local economy was massive.
What does that mean, being able to customize pricing?
You know, it's the things that I think we all kind of know, but don't realize how hard they are to do. So like if there is a place that, Jonathan, you've never been to, mm-hmm. and it's the kind that it's similar to other places you go, it makes all the sense in the world for that place to offer you a significant benefit for the first time for you to show up there.
Right.
But there's no way for them to really do that in an elegant way today. They can't just blast out to the world like, hey, everyone, come for a half price, you know, first purchase here. Right. Because there's no way for them to really do that effectively. Within a card system where you're controlling the movement of all the money and you have all that data and you have the communication with the cardholder, and you're able to do that very, very easily. And so then once you've made a first purchase, well, what about the behavior around the second purchase? You want to get someone to come back right away. Mm-hmm. That's what every business wants to do.
Yeah.
Very hard to do. Because how do you keep track of everyone? And, you know, how do you make this happen? Easy to do through a card system. Then what about when you're getting into the regular cycle of now someone has a habit? Well, not everyone's the same. So a college student who's living on their own has a very different spending behavior than a family of five. And so when offers are pushed out into the world, there's really no way right now to make sure that, you know, from the same business, they are pricing an offer to a person based on their spending behavior that's very different, you know, say it's the college student living on their own from someone from a family of five. And so there are these ideas that are pretty old, trusted ideas at this point about the right way to maximize the lifetime value of every customer. But the system to do it today doesn't exist. Like all these loyalty programs and promotions, it's all just, you know,
it's awful.
People hate it.
Yeah.
So that was a thing that kind of I was really struck by how powerful that was. And actually, after I sold the company, worked for 2 years for the company that the acquirer, and then launched a business to try and replicate what we had done, you know, in the community market, in the college market, mm-hmm. out in the open world, trying to do, try to do that in 2001.
What was the name of that company?
Tranvia.
In 2001. So 2001, the dot-com bubble burst, venture capital collapses, and you're starting a new venture?
I moved to New York. And in hindsight, I didn't really think about the bigger picture around it. It just sort of seemed to me like, you know, okay, I'd spent a couple of years with the acquirer, and it was time for me to just start the next
thing. Don't think too far ahead.
Don't think too far ahead. You know, right now, like today, this is sort of, now this is conventional wisdom, right? The whole idea of the business plan is gone. You're not supposed to, now you're supposed to be agile and iterate. So I was, you know, I was doing the right thing, not thinking too far ahead.
No, it sounds great. I mean, you know, you think too much and you'll just freeze up and not get anything done.
Right.
Okay, so we're talking about a payment system. It's so funny because the world's changed so much in a couple decades. You know, today in a modern context, you know, we think about this because we're sitting here and it's 2024.
Right.
This is 2001. I think I had a pager in 2001, and I was pretty cutting edge on the technology side. So how were you able to do it without having, I mean, there was no digital banking, there was no smartphones?
Great question, and great, that was the part I should have thought more about. I was just way too early. The goal of trying to use kind of like the MasterCard Visa system to be able to personalize the purchasing experience of every consumer and make far more efficient the way that every merchant could be able to engage with consumers. I thought, all right, this is me. I know how to do this, but I really didn't appreciate the role of the fact that at college campuses, everyone had email and everyone was on email and everyone was using their email. And like, and also you were already in a very defined geography. And so like the absence of geolocation, the absence of what you just said, all the different communication devices proved to be pretty fatal for the vision of what I set out to create. It happened that in an all boats rise with the same tide, the timing was excellent for being in the market with a highly nimble transaction processing platform. This was the time when mainframe computing was getting switched over to more modular systems. And we really took advantage of that and built some pretty cool technology. Like we were the first like gateway-less e-commerce processor. So the world couldn't handle receiving a transaction from a website without a layer of technology in between the two called a gateway. We built the ability to just receive that XML message format directly from an e-commerce platform. It's the kind of stuff that you would like. It's huge. You'd also think like, how could these big platforms that we were competing with are all 10,000 people plus. They're all multi-billion dollar companies today. They're all tens of billions of dollars companies. How could they not be able to just make that adjustment of being able to accept a transaction from a website? But they couldn't. So it's things like that that we ended up doing rather than the vision we originally set out to
do. Were you ultimately concerned that they could catch up to you, you know, and kind of just recreate what you've put together?
No, I wasn't. And I think that I was asked that a lot. And I think one of the things I notice about today versus even 10 or 15 years ago is I think people ask that question a lot less. And I think people understand that big companies, particularly big companies in financial services, rely on an innovation pipeline. There needs to be smaller, more nimble technology companies because it's so hard for them to make these little adjustments to their massive platforms.
Right.
However, the thing that did scare the hell out of me was the security environment. we were continuously under attack. There was always someone trying to get into our data center. And we were one of only 10 companies that were connected to MasterCard and Visa's network. And the other companies were all massive. And if we had had a security intrusion and got a letter from MasterCard or Visa that says, you know, you need to encrypt your database, we were done. There was no way.
Yeah.
So sold the company for that reason.
Sold it for that reason. And then when you sold that one, is that when you started OnDeck?
I took a little bit of a breather. I met my wife during that second company. We met on a blind date in New York and we got married.
Mutual friends set you up?
Yeah. She was subletting. Actually, it was a mutual friend. Also happened to be the guy who had called me when I sold the first company. He had actually initiated the acquisition. So we became very good friends out of that. A guy named Josh Shaw, who ended up being on season 4 of The Apprentice. So, yeah. So anyway, but he introduced us.
Nice.
We got married in early 2005, which was right about, I was supposed to close the sale of the second company right before the wedding. But you know how these closing dates can drift.
Yeah.
So we were on our honeymoon having to go take calls to try.
No.
Yeah, it's terrible. She's like, you've now coined the phrase working honeymoon. That is not good. But not anyway, good. So I sold the company. And then, you know, when you're acquired, there's sort of like high level, there's like two possibilities. One, you're supposed to be the person who like builds some entire new thing for them. Or two, they just want you to be nowhere. Like someone has a vision for what they're going to do with the asset they're buying.
Yep.
And they don't want the founder around.
Right.
And I was very happy to be the founder that they didn't want to really have around. So I spent a year on contract with them, but they were in Tennessee and I was living in the Hamptons. But I used that time to really understand something that had caught my attention a lot, which was all these small businesses that I had worked with over now almost like 13, 15 years. I kept hearing the same thing from them, which is that when they tried to get a loan from a bank, they got declined. I'd always been their payment processor, so I was always able to see their cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it made no sense why these businesses that were very healthy, successful businesses through the lens of payments, when they went to go get a pretty small loan, like maybe, you know, $30,000, $50,000,
$100,000,
would get declined. And I also, there was a thing called a merchant cash advance that was the alternative. When you were declined for a loan, you went and got a merchant cash advance, which was extremely expensive. And that led me to thinking about, like, there must be some other way, something in between declining people and them having to go to a merchant cash advance. And so I sort of used that time after that acquisition to kind of try and understand what was going on in the banking world and how credit worked and all sorts of things that I knew really nothing about.
Yeah.
But my attention was drawn to by the fact that there was this gap, a very clear gap.
So that was the motivation for starting OnDeck, which, is it true you started it at your mother-in-law's kitchen table?
I did. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I figured out early on was that you have no idea how long these things are going to take. And the one instinct I had about the lending business was no one was doing venture-backed lending platforms. And I was like, this is going to take a long time to figure out. And so I just kept overhead. I think for the first year and a half, I was working from an apartment, which today is not that big a deal, but back then was unusual. I think I had 4 VCs invested in the business and I was still one person working on my own.
How much money did you raise?
Initially, $2 million.
How'd you do that?
Well, I got introduced to Josh Koppelman, who had himself was starting a venture capital firm, which was First Round Capital, which is very well regarded and famous at this point today. And Josh is really one of the great venture capitalists. And then also Matt Harris, who was at the time Village Ventures. And he today is like a rock star in the fintech world. Matt Gorin, who's Contour Ventures. These guys were all starting out. And then there was another sort of more well-known person who's starting out, who's Vinod Khosla. And he's a highly regarded VC and sort of like Silicon Valley icon. And, you know, it's just through like kind of one thing leads to another. There's really no magic to it. It's about getting out there and just networking and kind of like one introduction leads to another. And the end result of all that was a pretty good founding set of venture capitalists.
That's amazing. Around what time was this?
This was like 2006.
It's right before the financial crisis.
That's right. Yeah, the idea was
burned into my memory.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and you know, the idea
was... You have a knack for timing, I see here.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people say, wow, man, you started an alternative lending system...
Of all things.
Right as the, you know, right as the main system crashed.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really, like, it was actually the opposite. Like, what I realized through that exploration period was the reason why banks wouldn't lend to small businesses was because they were using the personal credit of the business owner to evaluate the loan. And so if you have a neighbor who has a dry cleaner, like that neighbor is going to look through the lens of a credit score like a disaster waiting to happen, because all the credit that they used to set up or operate their dry cleaner is attributed to their household. So compared to everyone else on the street, they look like they have an enormous amount of, like, why do they have all this debt? Because the system never sees the cash flow. And so
that's insane.
Yeah. The more successful you are as a small business owner, the more likely you are to have a terrible credit score. That's also not to mention the fact that, like, there is no small business owner who has not hit many obstacles over the year on the way to success. And those obstacles will result in late payments and things like that. That makes it even worse. That also totally wrecks your credit score.
So how did OnDeck solve this problem?
So we kind of took advantage. It was the era of big data. And so the idea was we were going to use payment data and accounting data and all these things that had become software, and that software was connected to the internet. And so we could collect all that information and then basically deliver balance sheet cash flow and income statement at the same speed and scale as a personal credit score. And so that was the idea. And the idea was that, like, banks, so the banks will lend if you can remove the expense of how expensive it is for them to lend to the small businesses. And so we were just going to be a technology layer connecting the two.
I see.
And then when the collapse happened and the banks just, like, crawled into their shell, we had to then figure out how to build a balance sheet. And so I've raised $300 or $400 million worth of balance sheet capital to basically be the lender at that point.
To be the lender?
Yeah. So we had to actually step into the role.
You guys stepped in?
Yes.
You guys almost started a bank there.
Yeah. I mean, we tried as much as possible to not be in that position and to always just be the technology connecting the two, but we certainly had to do a lot to get that process started and to get into a place where then more of the traditional capital markets could be connected to Main Street, which is what ultimately ended up happening. Instead of the banks being connected to Main Street, it was more like hedge funds and private equity being connected to Main Street to fund the loans.
Wow, so interesting. So what was your growth like?
It was slow at first and then really, really explosive.
Oh, wow.
Takes a long time to get it all in place. And then, you know, I think by the time we went public, we were over $200 or $300 million a year of revenue.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it took 2 years to get the first loans made on the system, then took probably another 2 years to get to, you know, any level of, like, you know, $10 million of revenue. And then from there, it just skyrocketed.
That's amazing. So I love how you started this at a kitchen table, working out of your apartment. You have kids at this time?
All three of my kids were born during the run-up of OnDeck.
Oh, wow. So you've got babies in the apartment. You're working out of the apartment. And then you have this, as you approached the IPO and the business was really moving, were you still managing this largely by yourself?
Well, I had an incredible team that pretty early on, like once I got through that initial period of just figuring out all the regulations, all that kind of stuff, then hired a team. And Noah Breslow, who ultimately became the CEO of the company, was my first team member. I realized at a certain point that one thing, I was exhausted. Raising capital for 7 years straight was just brutal. Having, you know, a young family, it was just really, really hard. And the other thing too is that I realize that lending as a technology business, from a technology perspective, it's like the whole idea is when you build a model and it works, you don't touch it. And that's not a lot of fun from an innovation standpoint. And so I found it just being like a very kind of restrictive from like an entrepreneur's perspective or founder's perspective, like just a very kind of like almost like restrictive medium to work in versus something that's like a platform where you can keep innovating.
Right.
And so I started thinking a few years before the IPO that I really needed to find the right kind of leader for this type of business, and spent like a solid year searching for a CEO. And we really just couldn't find anyone who was a better answer than the talent that we had right there. I mean, Noah was incredible. And so from an entrepreneur's perspective, like going through that journey and getting to a point where, you know, your initial team, like Noah became CEO, Howard Katzenberg, who had started with us as like an he was an intern initially. I mean, he ended up being the public company CFO. It was an incredible rise of the team that was there to then run the public company. It was great.
What'd you do after?
Well, we had moved to California, which was a great way during this sort of this search process for a CEO, a great way to say like, hey, the founder's not going to be in your hair. Was I was like, well, I'll move to the West Coast and commute back to New York. And making it clear that like I was not planning to linger around. And, you know, so I then on Equipublic, it was like, I just need to take a break for a bit. And I got involved in advising Treasury. I was tapped to join this micro capital task force that advised Treasury and the White House on like how the financial system was working or not working for Main Street. There was like 87 federal small business lending programs, and they were delivering like 1/10 the amount of capital that OnDeck was to Main Street. And so it's really looking at like what could be done to try and create a better flow of capital to Main Street through the financial system.
Wow. Who'd you report to?
We were writing an advisory paper with a group of C-level executives and philanthropists and venture capitalists and policymakers. And so it was like, ultimately, you deliver this paper, and then that turned into some different innovation projects that Treasury ended up
doing. You're not around the conference table with the president, right? No. What are you working on now?
So I started in 2017. I got back into a startup. You know, the open banking, which a lot of people may be starting to be familiar with. Open banking is the idea that you own your banking data. The bank doesn't own it. The idea of open banking is that the bank has to make efforts to make it easy for you to be able to get access to your own data so that you can use any financial service that you want, not just the bank's financial service. That is a huge, huge change. It's something that was, in 2017, was happening around the world, and I was anticipating it would be happening here in the United States, which now it is. And the reason it's such a big change is because like for all these years, like banks are supposed to guard data and like keep, and it, which was their ultimate excuse to like potentially not do something is because like I've got to guard the data.
Right.
But now they were forced to share the data with platforms that are competing with them. And so that to me signaled that there was going to be a huge shift. And I actually got really interested in the shift that it would actually force the hands of banks to do more things rather than the idea that like I was going to go and compete with the banks, had kind of an eye toward working with the banks and helping them handle this next era that was coming. The second thing was AI. And in 2017, it was just clear to me that like AI was going to be a huge, huge shift.
You knew this back in 2017.
In everything. It was clear then. I mean, it was talked about more in the, I don't want to say that like I did not have my finger on the pulse of generative AI. You didn't need to. It was clear that we were going somewhere, and wherever we arrived at was going to be a massive change in how technology worked. And so those two things kind of got me interested in like the idea that this whole concept of personalizing financial services and the role that payment data could play in personalizing financial services was something that, you know, I wanted to get back involved in. It's kind of where I started.
Yeah. Technology caught up to you enough maybe to make this work.
That's right. That's really what it was.
Yeah.
Is that like, oh, okay, I'm going to go back and brush that idea off the shelf, you know, bring that off the shelf and go right back at it.
Right. So that's amazing. So what's the name of your company?
So the company is called Plink. And Plink is a transaction processing layer that banks can add to their existing infrastructure very easily. And what it basically does is it makes the payment card that's in your wallet or on your phone smart. And it enables you to experience much more personalized financial services, starting with the idea that the cash back in points that you receive today, that many of us have had the experience of going to our digital banking and looking at the screen and saying, like, why are these offers that getting presented to me, why do they have nothing to do with my own interests? Like, I don't purchase at any of these places. Mm-hmm. This is my bank. They're the ones that issued me the card. Like, how come they can't get me benefits at places that I go to?
Well, like you talked about in the very beginning, you said you described an environment where you have these three worlds, the merchant side, the bank side, and in the middle, the credit cards, and that none of them talk to each other. So is that still the case today?
That's still the case today. Wow. And the problem is really deeply rooted, because like when that original system was built, the idea was it was built to approve transactions, which if you think about it, is very simple math. It's just adding and subtracting. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've got this system that has 110 million businesses on it, 4 billion cardholders. It handles a volume of purchases that's 6 times e-commerce, like the total purchasing that goes through the MasterCard and Visa system. And all it can do is add and subtract. That's it. It's like a big friendly giant. And so the way it was originally built, the idea was like, keep these transactions as simple as possible. And so there's no, like in the actual little packet of information that zings around the world while these transactions are taking place, it doesn't include really basic information. Like the name of the business is often not there or has been redacted.
Yeah, sometimes you see on your activity, you're like, I don't know what this is. It doesn't look familiar to you.
Right. And that's all because when they originally built the system, they had to send that transaction over a copper wire, which is like a little tiny cocktail straw versus the internet, which is like a massive pipe. But the information zinging back and forth is still that original transaction. It doesn't have the address of the business. It doesn't have any other information about the kind of detailed information that when you're making a purchase, when you're working in any other system, there's so much more information that's passing back and forth. And so what our system does, one of the first things it does is it layers on all the missing information. It like cleans up the past so that then it can implement the future. And we've kind of taken on all of that.
This seems like something that banks would be interested in. Also, the merchants would be interested in. Who's your customer?
The customer is the bank. We have about 350 of them at this point. Our sort of edge of the wedge, the way we've managed to kind of insert ourselves in this sort of well-established industry, was by working with community banks and credit unions, because mm-hmm. you know, they're just smaller, and they also had just a really significant need, which is they wanted to be able to project their brand into the community. And so the way the sort of debit and credit card cashback and points world works is it all centers around these massive brands. And we all kind of, in whatever bank you're with, you kind of have the same handful of brands that everyone works with. So what we did was we said, well, we'll go in and set up a community network for each credit union or community bank. Kind of knew our way. We knew our way around how to go out and, you know, bring together a network of small businesses and connect them to a financial institution. And so that enabled us to get a seat at the table, and bit by bit started accumulating what today is now billions of transactions to be able to train the systems and do all the things we have to do to clean up the data, identify neighborhoods and communities, and be able to connect, you know, really make sense of what's happening with all the purchasing, so that then we can start to bring in the right merchants and connect those merchants to cardholders and present the right types of offers to the cardholders.
Right.
It's a lot more that goes into it than people would think when they're just sort of looking at that screen and wishing something was better. We've taken on all the work to make it better.
It seems like an amazing solution. Where's the resistance?
It's one of those businesses where there's like 6 things that have to go right technologically before you actually have something that's working. So, you know, we had to use AI to clean up all the data. There's a lot of machine learning and AI that goes into like figuring out, when I talked earlier about the idea of like a person who, you know, is someone who's going to school living on their own versus a family of 5, you don't actually know who those people are. You have to kind of intuit them through the data. Mm-hmm. And so building the models to be able to do all that, making those models work. And that's before you get to like, You then have to be able to create campaigns on the fly. You can't use marketing departments and groups of data scientists. Everything has to be completely automated if you're going to work at like the scale of small businesses or like the local level. It's got to be completely automated. So we had to automate how you generate campaigns, automate how you deliver those to a digital banking interface. And by the time we were done with all of that, you know, it takes 4 or 5 years. So it's not that we've really hit resistance. It's just we had to take a lot of time to build what we've built. And now we're getting a pretty fast pace of adoption.
Amazing. You're a serial entrepreneur. You've created a number of businesses. You've sold a number of businesses. What advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
You know, I think it's hard when you're doing all this stuff to really trust yourself that you're kind of, it's not the like what people talk about, the imposter syndrome. I don't think I ever felt like an imposter, but at the same time, I don't think I trusted my vision enough early on. And I was always looking for other people to sort of validate and say, you know, other people tell you like, oh yeah, you should take the next step. And in order for someone to tell you you should take the next step, they need to have the same vision that you have. And if you're someone who's thinking about and really drawn to doing something, you have a vision for it, other people aren't going to see that. Right. And so, you know, so you really have to trust in yourself. I think I've learned to trust in myself a lot more and rely on people not to validate what I'm thinking about, but rather to just help me build it. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that has... you'll end up staying on the right track if you do that. If you ask people, you know, if you're constantly looking for other people to validate that you have the right idea, you're going to end up tugged all over the place because they don't see the same thing you see.
Right. What's the best financial decision you've ever made?
I think something that worked out really well for my wife and I is that, you know, we were very decisive in terms of when we, for example, when we moved out to LA, we did not rent, we bought a house. And, you know, I think that we did that a few times where like, you know, it really worked out well for us that we bought assets that then, you know, appreciated. And I think it's easy to shy away from some of those bigger commitments. Like they feel like a tremendous amount of risk and you want to kind of really like take it, you know, a little more cautiously. And I think that it's okay to take some bigger risks, you know, and
stretch a little.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that if you're staying within like a good asset class, I think that that can be really smart and a hell of a lot smarter than other things you might do with that little bit of discretionary money you might have. I think we've been really smart about going to like trying to establish a base of assets.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Where can people find you?
LinkedIn. Mitch Jacobs on LinkedIn, plink.ai. Mitch at plink.ai.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything else that you're working on that you want to promote right now?
No, I just think, you know, just keep an eye out for a bank near you that says that they are, you know, powered by Plink, and you'll know that everything's about to change.
Powered by Plink. I love it. All right, Mitch, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Thanks, Jonathan. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Mitch Jacobs. Mitch discussed the importance of having a strong vision. This is true in business and in financial planning. Once the vision is defined, a financial plan is drafted, and a custom investment portfolio can be created. It all starts with your vision. If I can help you make your vision a reality, please reach out to me at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com. Now here's a short success story about someone you might know. At the start of the Korean War in 1950, 18-year-old Rex volunteered for the U.S. Army. He served as a mess sergeant in West Germany, overseeing meals for 2,000 soldiers and achieving the rank of staff sergeant. Despite his young age, Rex was well-suited for the task given his 6 years of experience working in restaurants, most recently at the Hobby House restaurant in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Adopted as a baby, Rex moved frequently with his father after his mother's death when he was 5. His first job was at Regis Restaurant in Knoxville at age 12. At 15, they moved to Fort Wayne, where he found employment at the Hobby House, dropping out of high school to do so. He later got his GED at age 61, as he later regarded dropping out of school as his greatest mistake. After his discharge from the Army in 1953, he returned to Fort Wayne and the Hobby House, which shortly thereafter became franchised as a Kentucky Fried Chicken, a budding new restaurant chain run by Colonel Harlan Sanders. During this time, Rex collaborated with Colonel Sanders on projects to boost KFC's profitability and brand recognition, suggesting a streamlined menu focused on a signature dish and commercials featuring the Colonel himself. Rex was then tapped to revive four struggling KFC locations in Columbus, Ohio. He simplified the menu and came up with the idea of a large, illuminated, revolving red and white bucket sign, which led to a quick turnaround in sales. By 1968, Rex had increased sales enough to sell his share back to Sanders for over $1.5 million. He used this experience and profit to start his own burger restaurant, naming it after his daughter, Melinda Lou, whose nickname was Wendy. Rex, whose full name is Rex David Thomas, called it Wendy's Old Fashioned Hamburgers. And that's the way he did it. Thank you again for listening. And a special thank you to producer Jake, content manager Angeline, and everyone else who made this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode of Success Unscripted, please like and share. If you have feedback, or if you or someone you know would be a good guest for our show, please reach out to us at affinitywealthpartners@ubs.com.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.